The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Crisis? Which crisis? There's almost too many to mention in the balmiest week for politics in quite some time. A week that started on Sunday with a Conservative Party cash for access scandal has seen a run on petrol stations, a rebellion over pasty taxes, and now a landslide for George Galloway as Labour are kicked out of Bradford West after 40 years. So our best laid plans to chew over the worst week for the Tories have had to be hastily readjusted to take account of a great shock for Labour too. Here to make sense of it all, we have The Guardian columnists Polly Toynbee and Simon Jenkins, as well as The Observer's political editor Toby Helm. A warm welcome to you all. Well, there's only one place to start, and as the man himself once said to Saddam Hussein, you have to salute his indefatigability. George Galloway, the former Labour MP booted out of the party in the Blair years, is back and has taken an incredible 56% of the vote to come from nowhere and win the Bradford West by-election.
And I want to, through this medium and through this result, appeal to the Labour Party to turn away and break decisively from the path of treason set for them by Tony Blair almost 20 years ago, and from which they have not properly resiled.
Galloway went on in typically grandiloquent Georgish style to salute the coming of the Bradford Spring. He's pleased, Polly, but just how worried or not should Ed Miliband be this morning?
Well, I think Labour's always needed more of a nudge from the left. So in some ways, although it'll be a terrible shock to them, it's not a bad idea to have somebody tugging on the other end of the rope and reminding them that there is a very large constituency well to the left of where Labour's been ever since New Labour was created, and you can't count on their vote. But of course, this is very much a one-off and a peculiar constituency, and it was about Iraq and Afghanistan more than anything else.
Toby, it's an unusual seat, one of 12 or 15 in the country that's got a majority of minority ethnic voters. It's behaved peculiarly in the past, I think swinging against Tony Blair in 1997, which nowhere else did. But it still feels bad for Miliband, obviously. But if you look at the figures, the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats lost just as many votes as Labour did. How do you read this result?
Well, you'd expect the Tories to lose, given the state of the economy, the appalling week they've had in terms of publicity. They're slightly reminiscent this week of John Major's government at various points, I think, sort of lurching from crisis to farce, and the tabloids going for them like nothing on earth. And the Lib Dems are associated with that. They're tainted by that as well. So I don't think either of those are a surprising. I think what it does show, though, for Labour is that they have to, if they are to take advantage of the current change of mood in British politics, they have to have some sharp messages. I think, obviously, this is a big one-off. Obviously, this is a very unusual seat. But Labour, I think if they're going to learn a lesson from this, it's that they've got to sharpen up. They've got to up their game in terms of having clear messages that people can hang on to Ed Miliband and say that's what he represents. I think people in by-elections at the moment think, bit of fudge, bit of mudge. I don't really understand Ed Miliband. Don't know where he's coming from. And they've got to give those people something.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I wonder about, Toby, is whether they just look too identikit now. You know, I mean, if you're sat in Bradford West, what is there to choose between Clegg, Cameron and Miliband down here?
I think people, that's absolutely right. If you look at Afghanistan, all the three major parties agree on, you know, that we should stay the course, we should stay another 2 years, see it out. People in Bradford West won't identify with that, and they'll go to somebody who's saying something identifiably different.
Though the irony is that Ed Miliband is the only one of them who said, actually, I never supported the Iraq war. He wasn't in the country at the time. He wasn't close to government at the time. But I suppose he has continued to support Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is turning into, you know, a 10-year calamity. And a lot of us, this paper, we supported it, think we were wrong now.
But Simon, of course, you never supported it, and you certainly didn't support the ramping up of troops into Helmand in 2005 or whenever it was. Do you think this is best understood as a rejection of interventionist foreign policy?
I mean, I think generally attributing huge significance to by-election results drives people mad, particularly when George Galloway is involved. Clearly, as Harriet Harman said this morning, there are special forces operating in Bradford. I honestly think the special factors operating in Bradford were so dominant as to wipe out all generalisation about Ed Miliband or the Labour Party. He fought very strongly on an anti-war ticket. He was in a heavily ethnic community there. I mean, I didn't go there. I don't know quite what was being said, but clearly this played very strongly locally. He's also a genuinely charismatic figure in a rather dull world of politics. And I mean, you know, George is a remarkable person. So I just think it's one of those total one-offs. It's just very difficult to draw any conclusion from.
Do you think Labour in any way saw this coming, Polly? I mean, it didn't feel to me like they were focusing on it 2 weeks ago.
No, they didn't. But if they'd watched the bookies, they might have taken fright, because the bookies in the last few days have been alerting everybody these huge bets going on to George. And, of course, Labour's lost one of its organisers a couple of days ago. And several people, you know, significant people in the area had slid over to George. So they might have seen it coming. Nevertheless, I don't think you could have predicted a landslide like this. And you might think that George Galloway had run out of his nine lives. I mean, we know he dresses up as a cat, but he seems to have a tenth life. After all, he has been accused of this, that and the other in the way of corruption, has almost always got away with it, except, of course, in 2007, when the Charity Commission did find that he had improperly taken at least £230,000 in donations. But that's, I think that's probably the only thing that ever got stuck on him. He's got huge lots of compensation for anyone who says it, from anyone who says anything different. But he is a magnificent orator. He is, in a world in Westminster now where very few people can speak well, he just shines like a light.
Well, of course, it's true that the establishment parties weren't in much of a position this week to lecture George Galloway about party funding. Unless the Bradford Spring sweeps the nation and the mill towns of the north, the political story this week that might be of more lasting significance could be last weekend's classic Sunday Times sting.
100 grand is not Premier League. It's not bad. It's probably bottom of the Premier League. 200 grand, 250 is Premier League. The first thing we want to do is get you at the Cameron and Osborne dinners.
The week after the government had slashed taxes for the rich, it emerged that Downing Street dinners, and perhaps more importantly, input into the Downing Street policy machine, are effectively being auctioned off by the Tory treasurer in order to bolster party funds. As fingers are pointed and U-turns are executed, one thing not on the menu at number 10 was humble pie.
None of these dinners were fundraising dinners, and none of these dinners were paid for by the taxpayer. I've known most of those attending for many years.
And for Ed Miliband, it was the proverbial open goal, not least when it emerged that the whole messy affair would only be investigated internally.
An inquiry into the Conservative Party, by the Conservative Party, for the Conservative Party. It is a whitewash and everyone knows it.
Simon Jenkins, with this first and then the calamitous advice from a Francis Maud in the Cabinet Office about people stockpiling petrol in illegal jerry cans and God knows what else. It's been one of those terrible weeks in government, isn't it? I mean, do you think this just happens to all governments?
Yeah, well, I think it does. It does happen to all governments. This was an absolute peach of a week. I don't quite know what to say. I mean, clearly it indicates a lack of direction at the centre. I mean, this is the kind of thing which even Tony Blair at his most sort of sleazy could kind of manage, because he had very strong central control. I think Cameron's eye has been really off the ball lately. He's been obsessed with foreign policy. He's been away a lot. He goes out a lot. He doesn't read his papers properly, I'm told. He just hasn't been in control, and it immediately shows. You just get one disaster after another. But the thing they can't seem to be able to do is they can't stop talking. I mean, every single minute, someone's leaping up with an initiative or a statement. There was no need to say anything about the petrol situation, and yet one person after another is contradicting each other, saying something or other. It just looks a mess, and as you say, the fact that it comes one day after another is even more remarkable.
Toby, pasties suddenly became a political issue. The news is sticky stuff, isn't it? Once one thing is kind of stuck onto a politician, all kinds of other weird things stick as well, including the innards of a Cornish pasty.
And it moved so fast. If you remember, it was only 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago that Downing Street were absolutely thrilled by the pictures of David Cameron with President Obama eating hamburgers. And they were the perfect pictures. And then suddenly, I mean, if you look back at it, what the frame for all this is created by Osborne's budget, the 50p tax thing. That creates the frame through which every other story is now looked, i.e. here's a government which is prepared to let rich people not pay tax and does nasty things to people without much money. So they put a tax on pasties, and the big contrast that everybody's drawing now is between the treatment of the rich and the treatment of the pasty eater in the north of England. And The Sun this week has been at its kind of super confident best as a newspaper, I think. You know, jokey, but making a serious point as well. Look at its front page this morning. It's a superb example of how to entertain, inform, and mock the government. Well, there's a big picture of a pie that they're giving away, free pies, which is a, you know, price in the shop, £7. You know, here you are. They're having absolute field day with it.
Do you think it's going to stick, Polly, or do you think, like so many of those worst weeks that they used to talk about in Tony Blair's bunker, it'll soon be forgotten?
No, it's not a worst week for exactly the reason that Toby says. The 50p cut will resonate all the way through to the next election and beyond. It brands them permanently and forever. It frames every single thing they do. So the pasties, which were a ridiculous muddle, where the Treasury had plainly not looked to see what the effect would be, that if a pasty cools on the shelf, you have to suddenly change its price, the sort of daftness of that, it became a class, a money matter. Everything they do now will become, rich people do or don't do this. This benefits rich people, not poor people, in a way that it was sort of under the surface, but people thought it was a bit below the belt before. You know, they can't help it. They were at Eton. What matters is what you do, not where you're from, and so on. I think that's gone now. Their cover is blown. And the 50p means that everything they do in future, every act of austerity, another 10 billion, 10 billion more on top of 18 billion of welfare cuts, that's going to be even harder for them to carry out.
So you see the main significance really is that every time there's a cut now, people go, you didn't need to do that because you could have kept this tax on the wealthy.
Absolutely. Every time people say, well, who was hit? You know, who was hit? And what's more, very large numbers of people on the 40p rate have not really been hit. I've not been hit, far as I can tell, not at all. You haven't got children, so you haven't lost your child benefit. Someone like me hasn't been hit. And I think there is a growing sense of who's really taken the wallop, and it's been the very poorest, and it's been mostly poor children, disabled children, women and poorer families and low earners.
The oddity here, Simon, is that although it may be true that David Cameron's worked very hard to develop this all in it together line, and although he may have tainted that, in the past, Conservative governments that are seen as unfair have nonetheless triumphed at the polls by seeming competent. Do you think the real danger of this week is that they might lose that?
Yes, I do. I think there's something's gone wrong in the relationship between David Cameron and George Osborne. I mean, this government was founded on that relationship. I mean, uncannily similar to the Blair-Brown one. And it just has gone wrong. I mean, I follow the planning thing very closely. It was abundantly clear that Cameron didn't know what was happening, and George Osborne was running wild with the lobbyists.
That seemed to turn out all right, though, didn't it?
It turned out all right. It turned out all right after the most horrendous battle between Osborne and the local government department, which Osborne lost in the end. But he lost it largely because his original proposals, or the proposals he was backing, were just so abundantly awful. But, I mean, the fact of the matter was, A, he lost it. B, he's lost this week. I mean, this week has been dreadful for Osborne. But Cameron ought to be in there somewhere. Cameron ought to be either supporting him or calling him to order. What you haven't seen this week is the sense of a man in control of his own government, and that's the damaging thing.
Simon, you brilliantly nailed, better than anybody, the extent to which the original planning plans were actually drafted the very same words by the lobbyists for the builders. And that seems to me is the kind of thing that resonates all the way through with the question of the contamination of money and the Conservative Party.
I think we agree. I think there's no question about that. I mean, one of the things that Cameron, people say the wisest things in opposition, has to be said. I mean, when Cameron said it's the lobbyists that are going to be the big scandal of the next government, I mean, boy, did he tell the truth. He's got a real problem now. I mean, he's desperately tried to be straight on cash for access and all that sort of thing. He's done far more than anyone did before. That's fair enough to say. The fact of the matter is, when you have cast iron evidence that people were effectively buying changes in the law, I'm sure they always have, but now we can see it much more in public, you've got a real problem. I don't object to people giving money to political parties. They always have, and I'm sure they always will. I do object very strongly to them being able to buy legislation, and that's the situation it now appears we were in.
Toby. The wider point here, I think, as well, is that David Cameron came to power having asserted that he was going to be the guy who made the little person have a voice in government. This was about what big society was, if you like. It would be much more bottom-up. Power would be shared, diffused to the many, if you like. And I think what this week's events have shown, whether it's, you know, whichever aspect you choose of it, what we've seen is that inverted, actually. We've seen people think, well, hang on, that hasn't happened. What we're seeing now is the rich people at the top governing for the rich.
What do you think, though, just immediately in terms of what happens next with this scandal? I mean, at the moment, it feels, because there wasn't Prime Minister's questions this week, there's an internal Conservative Party inquiry. Who knows whether or not there's something more up the Sunday Times' sleeve for this week. But if there's not, it feels like they're going to get away with just having an internal party inquiry, which will presumably say, oh, there's a big mouth there who's lost his job, and that's that.
Yeah, I think people will forget the details of the, you know, scandal, although it's a big one, and it will, you know, stay in people's minds to some extent. But I agree with Polly. I think that the overall impression is very, very powerful in people's minds now of a government that doesn't operate in the interests of the many and does do shady deals behind the scenes. And that is politics as normal. The whole period of Cameron's modernisation, if you like, has gone into reverse. And that, in the public mind, is, they will see that as politics as reverted to normal.
Can I come in?
Yes, please.
I mean, I think don't underestimate Cameron in this. He is an amazing operator at times, and I think probably he's the sort of person, he's not stupid. I think he's going to get the message very quickly, and I think there's going to be more trouble in the Sunday Times this weekend again. So he's not out of that wood yet. But I mean, I think if he gets a grip on a cabinet reshuffle or something like that, and in effect sort of pulls the game round, I still think he's not finished yet. So one can overstate a bad week. But it all depends on Cameron. There's no doubt about that.
I think it's hard to think that a reshuffle does anything. I think the Prime Ministers overestimate the extent to which most of the public have a clue who anybody in the Cabinet is anyway, for most governments, most of the time. And it's a bit sort of deck chairs on the Titanic to think that makes much difference. He's going to need to pull a big rabbit out of the bag, though. He's going to need to get back some of that old detoxification technique. Well, Steve Hilton's off and going in May. Who else has the flair and imagination to say, all right, I know, chameleon man, let's reinvent you all over again?
Yeah, the question is, can you re-detoxify your party? I think that's a big question.
I mean, it's very difficult, isn't it, Simon? Because, of course, you're in government. You can't sort of play the kind of noble outsider anymore. And what's more, you're in government when, even if you're going with a Labour plan rather than Tory plan, you'd be making pretty severe cuts that are going to make you unpopular.
Oh, that's true. I don't quite know what we're saying. I mean, life is tough in government. Life is very tough in government when you're making cuts. I think they've had a slightly charmed life for the past 2 years, and reality is beginning to bite. But I don't know. I mean, the past week has led to a surge in the Labour vote in the polls, the Labour result in the polls, and that will terrify them. There's no doubt about that. The Conservative Party have a very strong survival instinct. What they do with it remains to be seen. I mean, I think I would bring in a new Chancellor. I agree with Polly. Often it's just shifting the furniture around. But, I mean, what else do governments do? They tend to do this. It tends to work sometimes. Other times it doesn't work. But I think Cameron will be very strongly inclined to do it.
It's the first time anyone's even been talking, really, about George Osborne moving, isn't it, Polly?
Well, it's a very radical idea. And it may be that he has become too toxic. After all, what we've got to remember is, you know, when Simon says this has only begun to bite, the Institute for Fiscal Studies says 88% of the cuts are still to come. And they seem increasingly, oddly, to be backloaded so that you get close to the election. And then what's just beyond the election, they get worse and worse and worse. And you wonder whether people have the stomach for it. And if François Hollande wins the French election, whether there begins to be a change in the mood across Europe too about some of this extreme austerity.
Toby, what about petrol? We know it's been a toxic subject for governments in the past, most obviously in 2001. The weird thing about this crisis, they whipped it up out of nowhere. It wasn't there.
Well, I think the underestimated thing of this has been the extent to which it was quite obviously an attempt by cabinet ministers to deflect attention from the donations issue. Everybody's been kind of, most people have been rather too polite to say so, but I mean, you can imagine the discussion going on around the cabinet table a few days ago. You know, how the hell do we detract attention from this? Da 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 da. Right, Maud, get on the radio and
Let's talk up this crisis
with the unions. Lo and behold, he starts talking about jerry cans and causes a panic 2 weeks before there was even going to be the faintest opportunity of a strike. I mean, it is absolute farce, actually.
And how do you think it plays out? Is it Monday there are ACAS, the unions and...
Monday ACAS are supposed to be chairing a round of talks.
But if we now do get a strike, and then people are actually, rather than having to queue for petrol, are actually being told they can only have a few litres or whatever it is, do you think the whole profile of this and the profile of the strike, it might look clever in the end, or do you think it's beyond that?
I think the damage has been done. I think the farce element is too obvious. This is a self-confected
It was also
crisis.
A dirty trick that blew up in their face. The idea was to make the equivalence between Labour's cash from unions and particularly from Unite, who's the biggest Labour donor, together to counteract the dirtiness of what was revealed in the Sunday Times that the Tories were taking. Of course, there is no moral equivalence, whatever. Labour openly takes that money. It's all above board. There's nothing sneaky about it. You might think it's a wrong thing, but there isn't an equivalence there anyway, and so it rather serves them right that it blew up.
And Simon, finally, do you think we'll get anywhere on party funding? I mean, every 2 years, roughly, it seems that someone pops up, some great and good figure, saying, we need to have a deal which involves a cap and a spending limit and these other elements. And everyone says, good idea, and everyone objects to one of them, and then nothing happens. Same again?
I think so. I mean, I'm fairly relaxed about this one. I think that although Polly's absolutely right, that it is not the same, the unions and big business. It is certainly seen as being the same across the political spectrum. I mean, no Tory thinks that, and every Labour person thinks that. Where these talks always founder is simply on the Labour Party's unwillingness to see it as equivalent. And I think that'll continue. I don't think it's the end of the world. The most important thing, I come back to the fundamental issue, is that these kinds of payments, which I think are a customary way in which politics is funded around the world, these kind of payments should not be seen to have influence on policy. And we're pretty good about that in this country, except every now and then we go completely berserk.
Well, thanks very much. That's a good way to round off a rather berserk week in politics. My thanks to Toby Helm, to Polly Toynbee and to Simon Jenkins. I'll leave you all to get back to panic buying your hot pasties, petrol, and don't forget your first class stamps as well. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.